Here are the headlines from San Francisco. Archibald MacLeish sees solid foundation for U.S.-Soviet collaboration. James Dunn says issues outside the conference will not obstruct formation of new world organization. John Hickerson says question of trusteeship nearing agreement. This is the fifth of a group of State Department programs entitled Report from San Francisco, presented by NBC's University of the Air as a part of a larger series giving authoritative interpretations of our foreign policy. Assistant Secretary of State Archibald MacLeish will introduce the program from Washington. Immediately following, we will hear from Assistant Secretary James C. Dunn, who is the leading State Department advisor to the United States delegation at the United Nations Conference on International Organization, and Mr. John D. Hickerson, Deputy Director of the Office of European Affairs in the State Department and also an advisor to the United States delegation. They will be interviewed by Selden Menifee of NBC's University of the Air. And now we take you to Washington.
This is Archibald MacLeish. I had hoped to be back in San Francisco in time for this broadcast. In some ways, however, a perspective of 3,000 miles is not without its uses. You don't see as much of the brick-by-brick building of the walls, but you get a better sense of the look of the entire building and of the landscape in which it stands. It looks from here as though the conference at San Francisco had reached the point in its work at which the old New England farmers used to call in the neighbors for a barn raising. The foundations, originally laid at Dumbarton Oaks and vastly improved by the four-power discussions at the beginning of the conference, are pretty solidly in place, and the technical committees are well along with their job of nailing down the framework. Virtually all that remains to be done now is the drafting work of the coordinating committee, the public work of the various commissions, and the plenary sessions at which the technical work will be approved or modified and the building hoisted into place. But there's not only the new structure of the international organization to look at, there's also the world landscape in which the structure will stand. A good many people are discouraged by the look of that landscape. A good many indeed are impressed, unhappily impressed, by the contrast between the new and shining structure and process of successful completion in San Francisco and the dark and stormy world beyond its silvery towers. Specifically, and there is every reason to be specific, some observers see a striking contrast between our fortunate collaboration with the Russians in San Francisco and what they consider the failure of our collaboration with the Russians in Poland and elsewhere in Eastern Europe. It is now generally recognized, in spite of differences which have, of course, occurred, and in spite of the sensational headlines which introduced certain San Francisco stories earlier in the conference, that the real news of San Francisco is not the alleged crises, clashes, and collisions, but the fact that what might have been crises and what might have been collisions turned out for the most part to be cordial and understanding agreements. To some, however, the amity and agreement and common purpose in San Francisco merely served to emphasize, by way of contrast, the dark vistas which observers report in other parts of the world. Political events in Europe are regarded in some quarters not only as denying the promise of San Francisco, but as qualifying the hope that the continuing collaboration between the great powers upon which San Francisco is based can continue. Certain commentators have even spoken openly of an inevitable conflict of interest between the Russians and ourselves, and have debated the question whether Russia, our present ally in this war, is our enemy or our friend. A curious debate, one would think, with our soldiers living side by side in conquered Germany and our common dead but freshly buried. All this is as disturbing as it is confusing to the sensible citizens of this country. It would be serious also, tragically serious, if it were not for one thing, that the facts speak for themselves and that what the facts speak of is profoundly reassuring to any man who will open his ears and listen. The facts are these. First, the Soviet Union and the United States have proved in the most difficult geographic, economic, and psychological circumstances under which allies have ever attempted to act as allies, that they can work together in the difficult and trying prosecution of a total war. Second, the United States and the Soviet Union have proved at Dumbarton Oaks and at Yalta and at San Francisco that they can reconcile their views and arrive at common understandings on problems which have resisted hitherto the best efforts of the best diplomatic minds of many generations and which have never yet been solved. These, however, are only the more obvious facts. There are certain underlying facts which speak with equal eloquence. The first is this. The vital interests of the United States and the Soviet Union conflict at no point on the Earth's surface. The second is this. The United States and the Soviet Union are countries independently rich in their own resources, needing little from the world outside. And there is a third. The United States and the Soviet Union are both young, strong, self-confident countries with their own business to attend to. Countries which, however they may differ in philosophy and however they may differ in practice, aim in their several and dissimilar ways at what they believe to be the betterment of the lot of their own people and not at the conquest of the earth. There's no necessary reason, in other words, in the logic of geography or in the logic of economics or in the logic of national objectives, why the United States and the Soviet Union should ever find themselves in conflict with each other, let alone in the kind of conflict reckless and irresponsible men have begun now to suggest. There are differences between us, real differences. Poland is one. It will take will and time and effort, Russian will and time and effort, as well as American will and time and effort, to find an answer to Poland. But there is no necessary or logical reason why an answer to Poland or to any other difference should not be found. Indeed, the answers must be found. What underlies the current talk of inevitable conflict between the two nations, in other words, is nothing real, nothing logical. The basis of the fear is only fear itself. The basis of the suspicion is nothing more substantial than suspicion. There are apparently some Americans who are so uncertain of the vigor and vitality of the great American tradition that they feel the safety of our institutions is endangered by the mere existence, on the opposite side of the world, of a different and to us distasteful tradition and philosophy. There are doubtless some Russians who have similar fears of the great American democratic tradition, which has now emerged from a successful war as the most powerful moral and intellectual force of this generation. The answer to the fearful in both countries is the answer Mr. Roosevelt made to the fearful few in the United States in 1933. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. I cannot speak for the faint-hearted among the Russians, but certainly Americans who have so little faith in the vitality of the American tradition that they fear the presence in the world of a different tradition and are ready to regard conflict as inevitable, have little understanding of their own people or the history of their country, have little understanding above all of the meaning of the victory their nation and its allies have now won. It is true, in other words, that the landscape against which the structure of San Francisco has been raised is a clouded landscape, but no one expected that the end of the war would bring a return to perfect peace. It is true also that there are difficulties between the Russians and ourselves in Poland and in other countries, but no one ever doubted that the transition from war to peace would present the world with many difficulties. What is important is the fact that the American people and the Russian people have proved in war and proved in peace that they are capable of surmounting together the greatest difficulties with which peace or war can face them. What is important is this, that the true facts about the world, if only we will look at those true facts, prove beyond the possibility of question that there is no reason in logic and no reason in substance why the Russians and ourselves, given the will on both sides, to solve the problems which now face us, cannot make and preserve a long and lasting peace.
Thank you, Archibald MacLeish, for laying the facts on the line once more, as you've done so often in these broadcasts. And now, Mr. James Dunn, as Assistant Secretary of State for European, Near Eastern, and Far Eastern Affairs, you're in touch with most of these differences that Mr. MacLeish spoke of, the so-called crises which make the headlines from day to day. Poland, for example, and Yugoslavia and others. Do you think that these issues can be kept apart from the work of the conference?
Let me say first, Mr. Menefee, that our one job out here is to build a new international organization that will work. Such questions as the formation of a new government in Poland are definitely outside the purview of this conference. These outside issues will not obstruct our work here.
And what do you say, Mr. Hickerson?
I think that divorcing our work here from the problems of writing the peace is a necessary condition to our success. If we get involved in other issues here, we would have an endless task on our hands.
But the average reading member of the general public is apt to miss these fine distinctions. He's likely to ask how a United Nations organization can be set up, or can be successful at least, if so many local or national questions remain unsettled. What is being done now on the Polish question, Mr. Dunn?
You remember that at Yalta, the Soviet Union, Great Britain, and the United States agreed that the provisional government functioning in Poland should be reorganized on a broader democratic basis with the inclusion of democratic leaders from within Poland and from abroad.
Yes.
For this purpose, a commission was set up in Moscow consisting of Mr. Molotov and the British and American ambassadors. This commission was to consult with the members of the present Polish provisional government and with other Polish democratic leaders from within Poland and from abroad. Although there was no difficulty in agreeing upon what members of the present provisional government should be consulted, the commission was unable to reach agreement upon the names of the other Polish democratic leaders to be consulted.
Well, was that because we were proposing the names of members of the Polish government in London with which the Soviet Union had broken relations?
Not at all. None of the members of the present London government were proposed by us, although a few of the democratic leaders we suggested, such as Mr. Mikolajczyk, were formerly members of that government.
Tell me, wasn't it expected that the new Polish government would be established before the San Francisco conference?
That's right. Furthermore, when it was learned that Mr. Molotov was coming to the United Nations conference, the British and American ambassadors came to Washington and later to San Francisco in the hope that the new Polish government could be established in time for Poland to be represented at the conference. Before these discussions had gone very far, however, there arose the question as to whether any of the democratic leaders from within Poland, who it had been hoped would be called to Moscow for consultation, were among the 16 Poles who had been arrested by the Soviet authorities. We have asked for specific information on this and are awaiting a reply.
Well, where do we stand then, Mr. Dunn? Are the negotiations for the reorganization of the Polish government going on now?
Not at the moment, but the British and American ambassadors are now on their way back to Moscow, where they will continue their efforts to reach a solution of this problem.
And what about the latest European crisis, so-called, involving Yugoslavia, Mr. Secretary?
That seems to be very well on the way to a solution. In the past week, Marshal Tito has withdrawn his troops from southern Austria, and the situation in Trieste seems to be clearing up. The essential point here is that we are not now concerned with the question of what disposition should be made of these territories. That must wait until all claims to them have been fully considered. We do object to any seizure of territory before the final settlement.
And then there are some controversies in the Far East that need settling, too, like the division between the central government of China and the Yan'an communist regime.
That's a question for China to settle, Mr. Menefee. We want to see her solve her own problems. Our policy with regard to China is directed toward the most effective joint prosecution of the war and toward supporting China in her efforts to develop her national strength and unity so that she may best contribute to stability in Eastern Asia and to international peace. We believe that collaboration among China, the United States, and the other peace-loving powers interested in the Far Eastern area is necessary for the peace and security of that region.
Well, these controversies in no way affect the work of the conference, then, Mr. Dunn.
Of course, the news of these developments is continually before us, but our attention is on our big objective here, and we're spending all our time on attaining it, aren't we, Mr. Hickerson?
I think the present state of the world illustrates the tremendous importance, the necessity, of arranging for representatives of the important powers to sit down and really have a meeting of minds. In the past, we haven't had the machinery to do this. The meetings of the heads of governments were a beginning. They were very fruitful. I think they will continue to be useful. But meanwhile, here in San Francisco, we're making a further effort to try to bring local and regional problems within the framework of discussion by the countries represented in the new organization. Discord arising from unilateral decisions must be ended.
But some problems will continue to be dealt with through the traditional channels of diplomacy, won't they, Mr. Dunn? Outside the framework of the World Organization, I mean.
Yes. Each country will continue to have its own national problems and interests to take care of. The purpose of the organization is to promote the common interests of all nations and peoples, to further the maintenance of world peace and security. There's need for both. Through the machinery of the World Organization, there will be discussions of the common objectives toward which we are all working.
Can you give us an example, Mr. Dunn, of how our foreign relations will be handled on both levels, by direct diplomacy and through the World Organization?
Yes, take France, for instance. Our normal day-to-day relations with individual countries will, of course, be handled through regular channels, and these will continue to be of great importance. Our direct relations with France are of the utmost importance. Our friendship for her has lasted without a break for over a century and a half and is basic in our foreign policy. We feel that France is one of the fountainheads of liberty and democracy. It is to our interest to see a strong France restored in Europe. We also want to work with her in the international organization.
To Americans, one of the most gratifying aspects of the conference has been the participation of France as a power of the first rank. At the conference, the so-called Big Four has now become the Big Five.
Certainly, Mr. Hickerson. But we wish to go even further in our direct relations with France to help her get back on her feet. France can rely on our help, for a restored France is fundamental in our conception of the post-war world for whose peace and security we are laboring here in San Francisco.
The traditional diplomatic machinery of individual nations will continue to function, then, on a full scale.
Yes, Mr. Menefee. The World Organization doesn't mean that all foreign offices are going to be abolished and all communications handled through the World Organization. That's out of the question. We will still continue our direct communications with other nations.
Of course, only a super state, a single sovereign world state, could take over all international dealings, I suppose.
And we're not entering into a super state. But we are going to participate fully in the World Organization. I want to make that clear. We're going to make our full contribution to bringing about improvement of conditions in the world to make it possible to maintain peace and security.
In this connection, Mr. Dunn, it's interesting to note that you really rarely hear about the fear of surrendering too much sovereignty anymore. That ghost has been pretty well laid, hasn't it?
I think the matter of sovereignty has been largely taken care of by the Dumbarton Oaks proposals, because they made so perfectly explicit the conditions under which nations would participate in a world organization. Those conditions were made so clear, simple, and direct that it was possible for everyone to understand them. For that reason, we haven't had any of the complaints that came about the League of Nations Covenant regarding giving up sovereignty or concerning the extent of the commitments the United States was to have made.
As a newsman, Mr. Dunn, I'd like to say that the State Department has done a good job in getting the facts on Dumbarton Oaks and on San Francisco, too, to the public.
We've made every effort to bring these proposals to the attention of the public in order that they might read and understand and discuss them and raise any questions that they wanted to. But don't forget that we had the active help of hundreds of organized groups throughout the country who were just as interested in it as we were. And the press and radio have done a good job, too.
Well, now, with your permission, gentlemen, I'd like to turn to some current questions about the conference. Mr. Hickerson, I understand that you have been doing a good deal of work on the regional question.
That was one of the most difficult problems the conference has had to deal with, Mr. Menefee. The question of how to fit regional arrangements, like the Act of Chapultepec, into the charter of the World Organization.
Last week, Hamilton Fish Armstrong described the formula that we worked out with the Latin American countries. Since then, the Soviet Union has given her approval. How does it stand now?
Approval by the conference is assured. The additional changes merely clarified certain points, and the revised formula has been accepted by the technical committee.
And how would you summarize that formula?
The solution is one in which stable regional organizations, such as the Inter-American system, will have the responsibility for settling local hemispheric disputes by peaceful means. If disputes get out of hand and the regional processes don't look as though they would assure peaceful settlement, then the Security Council can take measures to ensure peace.
Yes.
If these measures seem inadequate, for example, if action by the Security Council is blocked by the difficulty of getting agreement in the Council and an actual attack occurs on any state, then all the American states will rally to the defense of the state which has been attacked.
I think that makes the regional formula very clear, Mr. Hickerson. Now, what do you think of the amendments submitted by the four sponsoring powers on the human rights question?
One of the things the American delegation has sought most of all was to give a more prominent place in the program of the World Organization to the recognition of human rights and freedoms. The provisions of the Dumbarton Oaks proposals have been expanded until recognition of human rights and freedoms has been brought into the basic principles and purposes of the organization and is one of its central themes. And then there's provision for the establishment of a commission on human rights.
I think that the interest shown in the subject here and the willingness to tackle the problem augurs very well for future developments.
Another point emphasized by liberal and religious groups especially, Mr. Hickerson, is that a commission should be established to provide for the progress of dependent peoples toward autonomy or self-government.
I think the proposals our delegation is making on the trusteeship, if adopted, will represent a step in this direction, at least for the areas under trusteeship. It is not possible to bring all dependent areas under the trusteeship proposals. This is something that would have to be negotiated afterwards. The important thing is that we are taking the first step here at San Francisco by providing enabling legislation. This enabling legislation will then be put to use if liberal opinion throughout the world gives its support to a broader international program.
The Japanese, incidentally, are making quite a propaganda campaign on this trusteeship issue. They're telling the people of Asia that our proposals are bad because they include self-government rather than independence as an objective of the trusteeship system. Would you care to comment on that, Mr. Dunn?
As the Secretary of State said, self-government is an all-embracing term which includes independence, where independence is desired by the people concerned, and independence is appropriate.
We can't dictate to all the world on this point.
The policy of the United States government has always been to encourage the improvement of the conditions of peoples everywhere, to the end that they might have the opportunity of fitting themselves for self-government and eventual independence. The important element is their right to be educated for self-government. Then it is up to them to make themselves capable of assuming the authority and responsibilities that go with self-government and independence.
One newspaper writer remarked the other day that what this conference needs is an advisor on semantics, that is, on the meaning of words. So much controversy has developed over the difference between such terms as independence and self-government, or full employment as opposed to a high level of stable employment, or as to whether the term culture clearly includes education.
I think the World Trade Union Conference at London last February gave a very good statement on this question of self-government. It referred to the right of all people to develop their own institutions of free citizenship. This conception of free citizenship is at the heart of the matter.
If you have that, if you're free to choose your form of government, it doesn't matter much whether you choose to remain part of a loose organization, the way Canada and Australia do, or whether you have complete independence, such as we are giving the Philippines.
Now, Mr. Hickerson, a good many organizations represented out here have also advocated provisions in the World Charter to protect the rights of small nations. There have been a certain number of amendments introduced by the small countries to accomplish this. Can you give us a rough idea of what the status of those amendments is?
The amendments which are already assured go very far toward increasing the power and influence of the Assembly. A great deal is being done to build up the Assembly, especially in relation to the functions of the Economic and Social Council. Our delegation has had the benefit of the combined views of the consultants here, representing religion, industry, labor, the farmers, and other groups, which has been extremely helpful. I think we'll succeed in getting some of the changes they proposed on the functions of the Assembly into the Charter.
What about the requirement that the Big Five, so-called, must agree unanimously before any action can be taken against an aggressor nation?
When it comes to the requirement for unanimous action by the major powers, Mr. Menifee, the concern of the other nations isn't primarily based on fear that these permanent members of the Council will abuse their rights. They have recognized that any decision concurred in by the United States, Great Britain, China, the Soviet Union, and France, and two other nations, isn't going to be anything very bad.
I think what the small nations are afraid of is that the veto power might prevent the taking of any action at all. They are afraid of inaction rather than action.
Whether or not the Security Council will be immobilized by the voting arrangements agreed on at Yalta is going to depend on whether or not the major powers find it possible to work together. It does not seem practical at the present stage to permit action to halt aggression by a smaller working majority than is represented by, say, the five permanent council members plus two others.
Under the Dumbarton Oaks proposals, action could be taken by the Security Council only if it has the support of the nations with the main military strength and a large part of the population of the world.
You know, Mr. Secretary, we've covered this question several times on these various broadcasts we've had from Washington and San Francisco, but it's such a timely issue, I think we ought to go into it a little further here. Actually, as I see it, there are three distinct veto powers. There is the direct veto power of each great nation over the use of military force to prevent aggression. Nobody objects very seriously to that.
No, I don't believe they do.
And then second, the five great nations have the same veto power, through the rule of unanimity, that is, over the application of economic sanctions or political pressures.
That's right. And that's just as essential as unanimity for military action. After all, economic or other sanctions are a phase of modern warfare.
But then there's still another veto power, a third veto power, Mr. Dunn, a sort of indirect veto, whereby any one of the five permanent members in the Security Council could even block recommendations for peaceful settlement of any dispute, that is, any dispute in which it is not involved.
That's right, Mr. Menefee. It's this third veto power, as you call it, that the small countries are concentrating their fire on, as I understand it. Of course, the small nations themselves are not entirely in agreement on this issue.
I think Norway's position is worthy of note, Mr. Menefee. According to the press reports, Norway accepts the principle of big power unanimity, the so-called veto power, for economic boycotts and embargoes, as well as military action. Norway prefers to have it modified, perhaps as regards other steps toward peaceful settlement. But the Norwegians point out that the major powers must stand together in support of all the charter if it's to be worth anything. They believe that public opinion, in any event, will put a brake on indiscriminate use of the veto by the great powers.
Of course, you realize that under the existing proposals, any country has the right to lay its case before the Security Council, where there would be full consideration and discussion. And there's one further point I'd like to add regarding this so-called third veto power, Mr. Hickerson. There is always the possibility that at any moment a dispute may move from the preliminary stage, where mediation or other peaceful devices may work, to the stage where there is a threat to the peace. There would be more weight attached to the deliberations of the Security Council, therefore, if there is unanimity on the part of the major powers with respect to whatever type of solution might be recommended.
Senator Connolly of our delegation has made a telling point on this issue. That is, that you shouldn't start even peaceful action unless you can carry through on it. That is, back it up by force, if necessary. And you can't do that if one of the major nations is unwilling to go along.
I suppose the reply to the 20 questions submitted to the sponsoring powers by the smaller countries on interpretation of the Yalta voting decisions may determine whether there'll be a sharp division of opinion on this.
Well, I believe in the final analysis that the charter, with the changes that are being worked out, will be a good one. Of course, we can't get everything we want, all neatly wrapped up and tied with a blue ribbon, at this first conference of the United Nations. The important thing is to get started, and we're doing that.
That was Assistant Secretary of State James C. Dunn, an advisor to the United States delegation at the United Nations Conference on International Organization. With him were Mr. John D. Hickerson, also an advisor to the delegation, and Seldon Menefee of NBC's University of the Air, who served as interrogator. Assistant Secretary of State Archibald MacLeish introduced the broadcast from Washington, D.C. This was the fifth in a series of programs entitled Report from San Francisco, broadcast to the people of America by the NBC University of the Air and to our servicemen and women throughout the world through the facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Service. Printed copies of the program are available without charge. Just send a card or letter to Our Foreign Policy, NBC, Radio City, New York 20, New York. Next week, we will hear from Congressman Charles A. Eaton and Commander Harold E. Stassen, both members of the United States delegation to the United Nations Conference. Assistant Secretary of State MacLeish will again introduce the broadcast, which will deal with the trusteeship question and other current developments here at the San Francisco Conference on International Organization. This program today came to you from Radio City in San Francisco and from Washington, D.C. This is the National Broadcasting Company.